What if we crossed the border and followed him into the swamps? Ricardo did not look up from his eggs and bacon, and Sean studied his face before he laughed mirthlessly. For a moment you had me worried. I thought you meant it. We'll get Tukutila next season. There isn't going to be another season, Ricardo told him. You know damn well that Jeffrey Manguza is going to pull your license and take Chiwewe away from you. Thanks, Capo. You certainly know how to make me feel good. There's no sense fooling ourselves. This is our last chance at that elephant. Correction, Sean shook his head. It's over for this season. We had our chance, and we blew it. Not if we follow him into Mozambique, Ricardo said. Follow him into the swamps. Sean stared at him. My God, you are serious. I told you, there is nothing I want more in this life than that elephant. So you expect Job and Matatu and me to commit suicide for a whim of yours? No, I don't expect it for a whim. Let's say for $500,000, rather. Sean shook his head, but no words came out, and Ricardo went on. I feel responsible for you losing your license. With $500,000, you could buy a goods concession in Zambia or Botswana, or 50,000 acres of game ranch in South Africa. $500,000. Think about it. Sean jumped up from the breakfast table so violently that he knocked his plate to the ground. He strode away without looking back. He stood alone at the edge of the camp, staring down towards the river where a small herd of impala were drinking and a white-headed fish eagle sat on a dead tree above the green water. He did not see them. He thought about what it would be like next year without his own concession. He owed his brother Gary almost $50,000, and his overdraft at the bank in Harare was touching $10,000. Rima had told him that the bank manager was anxious to speak to him. Sean had avoided the appointment on his last visit to Harare. He was over 40, and he had accumulated nothing. His father might be delighted to welcome him back to the family company, but his brother Gary was the chairman now, and he would be less enthusiastic. He thought about air-conditioned offices, neckties and dark business suits, interminable meetings with lawyers and engineers, rush-hour traffic and the smell of the city. He thought about his father's philosophy, heartily endorsed by his brother, that a man had to start at the bottom of the company and work his way up. Gary had more than 20 years' start on him. Gary loved it, and he hated it. He thought about $500,000. With that amount of money in his back pocket, he could thumb his nose at his bank manager, at Jeffrey Manguza and at Gary Courtney, and at the rest of the world, and tell them all to go and get stuffed. He turned away from the river and started down the path to Job's tent. Job was eating alone at his own campfire, served by his youngest wife. He gave her a quiet order to leave when he saw Sean coming. Then he took the coffee pot off the coals and poured a second mug and dribbled condensed milk from the can into it. Sean sat on the carved native stool beside him and took the mug from him. He spoke in Sindabili. What would you think of a man who followed a great elephant like Tukutila to his secret place in the swamps along the Zambezi? A man of such stupidity does not bear thinking of. Job blew on his coffee to cool it, and they were silent for a long while. Matatu, who had been sleeping in his hut nearby, sensed the presence of his master and came out, blinking and yawning in the early sunlight, to squat at Sean's feet. Sean let his hand rest on the little man's shoulder for a moment. He felt him wriggle with pleasure under the touch. He didn't even have to ask Matatu. He would go where Sean went without question, without a moment's hesitation. So Sean spoke directly to Job. Job, old friend of many years, I'll give you something else to think on. Montero wants to follow the elephant. He's offering $500,000. What do you think of $500,000? Job sighed. I do not have to think too long on that. When do we leave? Sean squeezed his arm hard and stood up. Ricardo was seated at the breakfast table with a cup of coffee and a cigar. Claudia was beside him, and they'd been arguing, The girl's face was still flushed and her eyes a sparkle, but she lapsed into silence as Sean entered the tent. "Capo," Sean said, "you have no idea what it'll be like across there. It'll be Vietnam all over again, but this time without the backup of the U.S. Army. Do you understand that?" "I want to go," Capo nodded. "All right, here are my terms. You will sign an indemnity for whatever happens to you. I'm not responsible." "Agreed." "Then I want a written acknowledgement of debt for the full amount, binding on your estate in the event of your death. Give me the paper." "You're crazy, Capo. Do you know that?" "Sure," Ricardo grinned. "But what about you?" "Oh, I was born crazy." Sean laughed with him as they shook hands. And then he sobered. "I want to fly a reconnaissance along the border to make sure there are no surprises waiting for us. If all is clear, we'll cross tonight. It'll mean forced marches and travelling light. I want to be in and out in under 10 days. Ricardo nodded, and Sean told him, "Get some rest now. You're gonna need it." He was about to turn away when he caught Claudia's furious gaze. "I'll radio Rima to send down another charter flight to pick you up tomorrow. She'll wangle you on the first commercial flight back to Anchorage." Claudia seemed about to reply when Ricardo laid his hand over hers. "Okay," he said. "She'll go. I'll see to it." "Damn right she'll go," Sean said. "She certainly isn't coming to Mozambique with us." Sean taped over the identification markings on the Beechcraft's wings and fuselage, obliterating them from the scrutiny of a ground observer. He made certain that the tape was so firmly adhering to the metalwork that the slipstream could not strip it away. While he worked, Job checked the emergency stores aboard the aircraft in case they were forced down. Rather than the heavy double-barreled rifle, he loaded Sean's lightweight .30-06 with a black glass fiber stock. They took off, and Sean banked into an easterly heading, keeping barely 50 feet above the treetops. He flew with a map on his lap, checking each landmark as it appeared ahead of them. Job sat beside him in the right-hand seat, while Matatu was in the seat behind Job. After all these years, Matatu was terrified of flying and still occasionally suffered from air sickness. Sean refused to allow him to sit in the seat behind him. "Silly little bugger will puke down the back of my neck again." So Job had to run that risk. They reached the border and turned northwards along it, searching for troop movements or for any evidence of human presence. They found nothing. Until 30 minutes later, they saw the sheen of water on the horizon, an inland sea formed by the man-made dam on the Zambezi River. "Kabora Bassa," Sean grunted. The hydroelectric scheme, one of the biggest and most expensive in Africa, had been built by the Portuguese before they relinquished the colony to self-government. Although the South Africans would have taken all the power that the project could supply, transporting it southwards across the grids to their great mines at Palabara in the Transvaal, and the revenue would have gone a long way to alleviating Mozambique's desperate economic plight, Kabora Bassa no longer sold a single kilowatt of electricity. The southbound power lines were continually sabotaged by the rebel forces, and the government troops were so demoralized that they made little attempt to protect the repair crews from attack. Thus it was years since a repair had been properly attempted. "By now the turbines are probably just piles of rust. Score another sweeping triumph for African Marxism," Sean chuckled, and dropped a wing to turn 180 degrees and head back southwards. On this leg, he flew deeper into Mozambique, setting a zigzag course to cover more ground, once again searching the occupied villages for mobile military units. They found only the patterns of old cultivated lands, now gone back to weed and bush, and burnt-out deserted villages with no sign of human life around the shells of roofless huts. Sean intersected the road running between Vila de Manica and Kabora Bassa and flew along it for 10 miles. He was so low that he could see the ruts and potholes in the surface and weeds growing in the wheel tracks. No vehicle had used it for months, perhaps years. The culverts and bridges had been destroyed by explosives, and the bodies of mined vehicles, burned out and rusted, littered the verges. He turned back towards the west and the border, searching for a place that all three of them remembered so well. As they came up ahead, Sean recognised the symmetrical hillocks they called Iholozane, the maiden's breasts, and south of them, the confluence of two minor rivers now reduced to strings of green pools in wide sand beds. Job pointed ahead. There it is. And in the back seat, Matatu forgot his fear and discomfort to cackle with laughter and clutch Sean's shoulder. In Lozane. Do you remember, Bwana? Sean banked steeply over the junction of the two rivers, circling them, all three of them peering down. They could make out no traces of the old guerrilla camp. The last time they had been here was in the spring of 1976, and they had come as the scouts, Ballantine's scouts. Under interrogation, a prisoner had revealed the existence of a major guerrilla training camp in this area, and the Rhodesian High Command had sent one of the vampire jets over on a high photographic run. The camp had been cunningly concealed, and every artifice of camouflage employed. However, the Rhodesian evaluators were highly skilled, most of them ex-RAF personnel. It is possible to camouflage the dugouts and hutments used by hundreds of men and women, but the pathways between them are the telltales. Thousands of feet moving daily between barracks and lecture huts, between mess halls and latrines, going out to forage for firewood or carrying water from the river, beat pathways that from the air look like the veins in a dead leaf. Between 2,000 and 2,500, the Air Force Photographic Reconnaissance Squadron leader had told the briefing. They have been there for approximately 6 months, so training is almost complete. They're probably just waiting for the rains to break before beginning a major offensive. A simultaneous incursion by 2,000 trained terrorists would have strained the Rhodesian security forces' capabilities to breaking point. Preemptive strike, General Peter Walls, the Rhodesian commander-in-chief, had ordered. I want a battle plan prepared within 24 hours. The code name chosen for the attack was Popeye. Rivalry between the Silas scouts and the Ballantine scouts were fierce, and Sean had been jubilant when he'd been given the ground attack role of Popeye in preference to the Silas scouts. They'd gone in with the slow and ancient Dakotas, crowding on the benches along the fuselage, 50 men and their equipment to an aircraft, sitting on their parachutes. Almost equal numbers of black and white troopers, but homogeneous in their camouflage paint. They had jumped from 300 feet, just enough height for the parachutes to flare before they hit the ground. From that height, they jokingly referred to themselves as meat bombs. The jump area was 12 miles from the guerrilla training camp and 96 miles inside the Mozambique border. They were on the ground an hour before sunset. All 300 scouts were assembled and ready to move out by nightfall. They had made the approach march by moonlight, each man carrying a pack that weighed almost 100 pounds, most of that weight made up by ammunition for the RPD machine guns. They'd reached the fork of the river after midnight and prepared their ambush position along the south bank, overlooking the dry riverbed and its shallow green pools, facing the training camp on the far bank. Sean, with Job beside him, crept along the bank, checking every position personally, speaking to his men in whispers, calling them by name. They had lain for the rest of the night behind their machine guns, and the small sounds and the smells of the wood smoke and cooking food had drifted across to them on the night breeze.